School Suck supporting listeners are raving about our bonus series, The Discomfort Zone. But what is The Discomfort Zone? What do we do on this show?
It's a vent for a lot of shit that happens in our life where we make lemonade. You know about this? How you take lemons?
No.
Oh, you've never heard this?
No.
Okay.
Explain.
There's a saying, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade.
I don't get it.
Okay. Lemons.
I like lemons as they are.
Wow, that's really the right approach.
I don't care for lemonade.
That's
pink lemonade. I know that's very lame, but I like pink lemonade.
Well, what I'm saying is I don't want to torture this metaphor.
How many lemons?
It varies. It's just you turn each one into like a sweeter beverage.
Do I have to convert them all to lemonade? Or can I keep some of the lemons as they are?
You know,
because at least with a lemon, I can play catch with myself. Like if I was locked in a jail cell and you said, okay, you can have a lemon or you can have lemonade, I'll take
a lemon. Because you can
every
catch
time.
With yourself.
Exactly.
And then have a drink.
And if I get mad enough, I can throw it at the door and smash it on the wall and smear it. And it smells nice. But the lemonade smells nice too. But the lemonade is going to get ultra sticky. So lemon every time.
Well, sounds like you really have the right attitude. Like your attitude is so good that this metaphor doesn't even. Anyway.
My attitude is don't make lemonade. When life gives you lemons, be happy.
Wow. Very stoic.
Yep.
So we take our own problems and frustrations and we turn them into other people's entertainment and our entertainment in the meantime. And that's a very nice gift to ourselves and to other people. And it's something that we should cherish.
And I really like that we have some amount of very dedicated listeners, no matter how little that amount is. Each one of those listeners is my little lemon.
That's very sweet.
Yeah.
But well, it's sour. But
it is. But if I had too many lemons, what am I going to do with all these lemons?
So make lemonade.
Well, it seems like a waste of effort.
It's good to have options.
Coffee beans to coffee. That's a better analogy.
Coffee beans are gross.
Right, until you make coffee out of them.
Oh, what a treat.
And there are three ways you can access all episodes of The Discomfort Zone, which is perhaps the greatest subscriber-only show in all of podcasting. Perhaps. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV, Patreon.com/SchoolSucks, and SubscribeStar.com/SchoolSucksProject. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit SchoolSucksProject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for SchoolSucksProject.
Nobody that I've ever talked to can say, yeah, I know a woman who could not stand her body. She didn't change anything about her head. She only changed her body. Now she's super happy. No, she's ripping herself apart, maybe for different things, but probably likely still the same thing. She wanted to be a size 6. She got there. Wasn't good enough. Now I got to be a size 4. Now she's a size 4. She wants to be a size 2. And that's making her feel horrible, but it doesn't matter. Because she can't find happiness out there hiding in this game of hide and seek. And she's got to keep looking for it instead of creating it. Just like you treat your kids. You nurture your kids into the most awesome creatures you can make them because you love them. Not so that you can eventually love them.
Right.
Not so
right.
that if you develop them out far enough, you will be able to love them.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today, a conversation with a man whose work dramatically improved the quality of my life over the last couple of years. And I hope you find this helpful. Thanks for listening. Here we go.
Used to ride the highway. I used to know where I was going. Now this shady dirt road is feeling cool beneath my feet. Used to ride on to get to where I was going in a day. Now I've got to stop, go and stop, go along the way.
My guest today is Jason Seib. Jason is a fat loss coach, fitness and nutrition author, and speaker. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
I was on your website today, and it says that you work exclusively with women now. Yet, here I am.
I'm not trying to exclude men. It's just the direction that my career has gone in. And as we'll probably get into, you know, today as we talk, the things that I do with women are oftentimes in large part about what makes people quit. And those answers are so different between men and women that, you know, I do have some things that's not entirely true. I do have some things that men are and can be involved in, but my message overwhelmingly is aimed at frustrated yo-yo dieting women with body image issues. And like I said, the answers for them are quite different than they are for the men.
I gotcha. So in a minute, we're going to talk about how you get started with that and how you get to where you are now, just through your background a little bit. Cool. But I bought into your work in a big way over the last 2 years, and I did so with great results. I think it was a friend of mine back in 2017 where we were talking about kind of stalling out or plateauing with low carb or ketogenic diets, even paleo, not getting some of the results we wanted. And he said, well, there is this other thing that I've been hearing about, but he had just had a bunch of blood work done and he had concluded, at least at that time, that any phase of ketogenic eating wasn't good for him. So he passed it off to me. I looked at your book and my first response after flipping through it was, this looks fun. And I tried it for a month back in 2017. I had let myself go a little bit, and the results that I got in a month were pretty incredible. And then I had to put it off because I was traveling at the end of that year. And I picked it up in February of 2018, and I've been doing it for a solid 14 months since then. In fact, a really good friend of mine who's a little shorter than me, I'm 5'10", had grown to over 200 pounds of not muscle. And he had tried to do a low carb diet. He had, you know, results that are common with low carb diets. He lost a bunch of weight pretty quickly and then he kind of plateaued. So I came out to visit him in February where he lived and I said, I've got one other thing that you could try. I broke the plateau and got down to a healthy weight, lost another 20 pounds of fat. And maintains that weight to the day. He is my accountability partner with this eating lifestyle. I don't like to call it a diet. I think I know it is called what we're going to talk about, the alt shift diet. But diets sound so temporary.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
So rooted, in sacrifice. So recently, building on all this success, I was looking for ways to optimize my diet and fitness pursuits, which is, I think, actually like a self-forgiving way of addressing the mistakes that I know I'm making and the slips that I'm experiencing. And so I was revisiting the book and you wrote a supplement on like a fitness plan that went with the book Alt Shift Lift. And so I'm revisiting these resources I have. And I was saying, I think this was just like a couple weeks ago, I wish I could talk to this guy. And then I remembered that I have a show and our policy is that if it's educational and it's not taught in school, we can cover it. So your philosophy also aligns with the previous health and fitness coaches, friends of mine that I brought on the show. And it also aligns with what's proven successful for me. So here you are.
Perfect. Yeah. This is going to be great.
You came out of, or you made a name for yourself, we could say, in the paleo scene. I know Rob Wolf was one of your mentors. How did you get started and what led you into developing this Alt Shift protocol?
Well, going all the way back, I, you know, kind of a pain in the butt teenager, constantly getting in trouble, making my poor mom go gray early.
Oh, these poor moms. Yep. I have one too.
Yeah. And so what saved me from that right around just before my 20th birthday was that I got into working out and immediately fell in love with the geek side of it rather than just the gym rat side of it. And, you know, I'm 45 years old. So we're talking about going back to when you couldn't just get online and look up research papers and things like that. So it was in the library and on microfiche and all that kind of stuff as I did, as I geeked out and did research and really got into it, went through the regular gym scene. Once it became the, we got into a place where I believed that I could make personal training my primary source of income, because prior to that, I was just kind of helping some people out here and there. And then really started getting into nutrition heavily at that point. And I think if you are somebody who reads a lot of research, and you know, this might get me some hatred, but my personal belief is that if you are somebody who reads a lot of research and does a lot of studying, as opposed to reading, you know, articles and blog posts and maybe listening to the medical community, what you end up with is a perspective based on evolutionary biology. It's the only real thing that makes sense. And if we talk about this from the perspective of like zoology, like looking at animals, it's just crystal clear. Nobody ever argues with that. But as soon as you apply it to the human animal, it's like, nope, that's not right. We should not eat the way the human animal would have eaten in nature. But going down that path, you end up at paleo, primal, evolutionary, whatever you want to call it. And unfortunately, some of those things have turned into diets, which means that they are now a set of rules and dogma rather than the question, what do humans eat? And, you know, if humans didn't eat those things, you know, back in caveman times, they're suspect. We should look at them closely, but it doesn't mean that they're now against our new religion. So in the paleo world, I always had those frustrations, but I did pretty well there. Sarah Fragoso of Everyday Paleo and I, we were traveling around the country doing seminars, and we had a podcast that did really well and was always ranked pretty well on iTunes and a pretty big following. And I wrote The Paleo Coach, my first book in that time. And that book was broken into three sections. Interestingly, the first section was the think section. And so it was think, eat, move. And then I created the Alt Shift Diet in 2015. September 3rd of 2015, we released it. 2 days later, we launched the Alt Shift Facebook group. The diet exploded and did amazing things, and I was swimming in testimonials. And then, well, all kinds of crazy things happen that might be jumping ahead of where you want to go in order in this podcast. But that sort of brings us up to date with the physical aspects of what I do. To that point, I developed Alt Shift because paleo was sort of unsatisfactory for what I was trying to create as a weight loss coach. It was a very good diet to improve health and a very good diet to, you know, make your tummy feel better and maybe get rid of your headaches and make your skin and hair good and all that. But not everybody was getting what they had read about in the paleo brochure when it came to weight loss. So Alt Shift was sort of an extension of that, that also took into account not just the types of foods people would eat, but how they would have taken those foods in. And, you know, in thinking about how we would have lived as hunter gatherers and not just which foods would have been on the list. And so I think that brings us up to date for what your question was there, unless you want me to go deeper into the mindset stuff yet.
I wanted to mention it for sure, because it seems like that's the turn you've taken since then. And the people I've really wanted to listen to in this space are the ones who have paid some attention to root causes, making it about mind, not just body. I mean, obviously, like the online fitness industry, it doesn't seem like the most honest industry. It seems like it plays a lot on people's vanities and insecurities. It seems also like short-term oriented. It doesn't really factor in sustainability, not just physically, but mentally in a lot of cases. So it seems like recently you've tried to address more of that as well.
Yeah, let's do that now then. So
I'd love to hear about that.
Okay. I released Alt Shift. 2 days later, released the Alt Shift Facebook group. So what we had now was the Alt Shift diet and a group to support the Alt Shift diet. And I was instantaneously, you know, within a couple of weeks, just swimming in before and after pictures. I mean, amazing testimonials, freaking believable what was happening. And I was like, I did it. I created the thing that I had always set out to do. All of these people are getting results like the results that you talked about yourself getting in the beginning of this podcast. And then the inevitable happened and almost all of them quit. And then a huge majority of those people would come back to me and literally oftentimes ask me why they quit. They'd say, I did it. It worked so well. I felt good. I got great results. Look at my pictures. And then I just faded out of it. Or I ate a cookie and then just gave up. Why did I quit? Why did this happen? And I had already been saying for years with Sarah Fragoso that my job was about minds, not bodies. That solidified it for me. Because if you ask people what they want, what do you want from a coach like me? They'll say, well, I want to lose weight. So I can get a little facetious about that and say, okay, so you just want to lose weight, but you don't really care if you gain it back, right? Well, no. I'd like to lose weight and be able to keep it off. Okay. You want to lose weight, keep it off, but you don't really care if you feel like crap all the time, because it's a diet that doesn't really produce health. Well, no, I want to lose weight, keep it off and feel good. Okay. You want to lose weight, keep it off and feel good, but it doesn't really matter if it's super hard. No, I want to lose weight, keep it off, feel good. And it's got to be easy enough that I can do it every day. Okay. Now we're at the root of what you actually want. And I had given them that and they were all telling me that, but they quit anyway and they didn't even know why they quit. So my only question at that point became, why do people quit? So I started working with my psychologist friend, Robert Biswas Diener, who has a huge career. He talks all over the world. It's massive career in psychology, mainly positive psychology and coaching. And we started brainstorming most weeks together for quite a long time. And we're still getting together on a very regular basis and digging into this stuff right now. And the outcome of that has been a really deep dive into what causes people to quit losing or to quit something that's working for them. And so I wrote Body Beliefs, which was my next book after the Alt Shift books. And it did very well. What it comes down to is that nobody ever quits any diet ever because of the rules of a diet. Nobody ever quits a diet because of carbs or protein or fat or calories. They quit because of things like one bite won't hurt. I deserve a treat. I don't deserve success. This won't work for me anyway. It isn't working fast enough, or that just looks like it'll taste really good. So screw the last 23 and a half hours of my every day that I tell myself I want this thing. I'm just going to eat it now and deal with the consequences later. It is always, always a thought process. And then when people fall off the rails, they do things like I said a minute ago, they'll eat a cookie and they will, you know, they're very extrinsically motivated, which means I've now ruined something and I wasn't learning a skill. I was doing all of this stuff I didn't want to do. I don't want to live like this. But I have to, because this will just love me the way I am. So I have to do this. And so the very second they eat a cookie, they've ruined something. So they quit for 3 weeks. Unlike, let's say you're trying to learn how to play the violin and you draw the bow across the strings 3 or 4 times, you hit a sour note. What do? You go back to the beginning of the song and keep playing. You don't slam the violin in the case and throw it up in your closet for 3 weeks and then go find a different guru or even a different instrument to learn how to play. So when people give up after a period of time, or even just a really short period of time, what do they do to get back on track? They immediately start addressing the rules again. I quit because I told myself I deserved a treat, which is very much like saying I did such a great job cleaning my house, I deserve to throw a big handful of dirt on my living room floor. But because I quit due to this thought, how should I get back on track? Well, I need to make a meal plan. Wait, what? Like, you're going back to the rules to try to address a problem that was not ever created by the rules. And so what this comes down to every single time for the women that I work with, like I said a moment ago, the type of motivation they have is always extrinsic. They believe that if they turn themselves into something else, they will finally be valuable enough. In other words, I don't like me. And I believe the world doesn't like me. So if I can make myself into something else physically, I will finally escape all of this horrible abuse. And who's doing the abusing? Only themselves.
Yeah, right.
So yeah. So they get up every morning and they do this to them. So let's use the analogy of a child. You have a kid. Let's say my 8-year-old Daphne. Let's say every morning I get up and I look at Daphne and I say, "Oh God, you're such a disappointment. I don't know how you let yourself get to this place. Like, aren't you ashamed? Disgusting, horrible child abuse." And yet it is the exact plan that most of the women listening to this are using to try to create beauty in themselves rather than nurture themselves into something awesome because they're already worth it. They're trying to create worth through abuse. Right. And of course it never works, because why would it work? You will quit at every turn. Let's think about stress for a second. If you think like the way I just laid out, you're extrinsically motivated. You think you're doing this for everybody else, but what you're really doing is trying to escape your own self-abuse. And stress hits. You hit stressful times in your life. What's the very first thing that you have to do in stressful times? You've got to get really selfish. You've got to go, this stress is forcing me to deal with my crap. So all of you jerks, you guys all need to step off for a while. I can't pay any attention to you. So the very first thing I'm going to do is quit eating this way, because I always hated it anyway. I was only doing it to please you, even though doesn't really exist. What you're really talking about is me. I'm doing it to try to get to a place where I can see my picture on Facebook and not rip myself to shreds for an hour, or catch my reflection in a building and not do the same. That's the thing that they're hoping is eventually going to happen. But they're trying to do it through abuse, which means at every turn they can talk themselves into quitting. So how could this ever add up to success? Short-term success is everywhere, but the whole world is yo-yo dieting because nobody's doing anything that looks like self-care. And as a matter of fact, their goal isn't even to be happy. It's just to be not miserable. Their goal is to just lose enough weight that they don't hate themselves or they're not mean to themselves. And some women will say, well, I'm not that bad. I don't say those kinds of things to myself, Jason. Really? Look at your friend one day. Look her right in the eyes and go, oh, God, you need to change that shirt. It makes you look fat. Guarantee you say that kind of stuff to yourself at least once in a while. Say that to your child. No.
Right. Yeah.
It's you do not have success at the end of this path. I will bet my bottom dollar on it.
Yeah, a lot of it probably too in the extrinsic factors would be about making some kind of change and collecting compliments or getting noticed by other people, but not doing it for really internally motivated ways. I bet that's something you probably hear a lot too.
Totally. It's I am going to do this and I think I may have lost some weight. So the first thing I do is I go and jump on the scale. Like my pants are falling off me and I feel better today. Let me jump on the scale and see whether or not I should actually feel good about this. And if the scale agrees and I am down, then I need to get outside and look into the eyes of strangers or those fringe people and see if I can find value. See if I can find some value for me, because your loved ones don't love you any more or less when you gain or lose weight. The people who hate you don't hate you any more or less. You're doing all of this for those people on the fringe. And the biggest, most amazing reward, when I ask women, why do you want to lose weight? They stutter. Because the biggest, most amazing thing that's going to come out of this is some people are going to walk by you in the hallway at work or wherever you hang out, and they're going to look at you and go, hey, you look like you lost weight. And that's it. Your kids are not going to make honor roll. You're not going to get a raise. They're not going to kick in your door, throw money at you, and make you date supermodels. The only thing that's going to happen is a few people are going to walk by you. But beyond that, every answer to why do you want to lose weight will be, well, I would feel or I would think – I'd be more confident. It's always something internal that they're conjuring up in their own head that they could change right now and set themselves up to actually get long-term results. But that's not what's happening. It's, I need to escape what is in almost entirely me. I need to escape me. And the only way I'm going to do that is to be able to eventually look in the mirror and see something I like, which never happens. I mean, even if you lose all the weight, you just whip out a magnifying glass and get closer to the mirror. You know, last week it was your fat. Now this week it's your stretch marks. And nobody's ever seen this anywhere. Nobody that I've ever talked to can say, yeah, I know a woman who could not stand her body. She didn't change anything about her head. She only changed her body. Now she's super happy. No, she's just as insecure. She's ripping herself apart, maybe for different things, but probably likely still the same thing. She wanted to be a size 6. She got there. Wasn't good enough. Now I got to be a size 4. Now she's a size 4. She wants to be a size 2. And that's making her feel horrible, but it doesn't matter because she can't find happiness out there hiding in this game of hide and seek. It's not behind that bush that she thought it was going to be behind. So she's got to keep looking for it instead of creating it, making it inside herself, because she's already rad. Just like you treat your kids. You nurture your kids into the most awesome creatures you can make them because you love them, not so that you can eventually love them, not so that if you develop them out far enough, you will be able to love them. That perspective is the only way to success. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen it, but this industry doesn't really get it. You mentioned the industry earlier, and I don't know whether or not I hate them for it or they're just oblivious, but when you do what I used to do and you sit around and you research the science of what it takes to make people lose weight, you are ignoring the fact that this industry, by and large, has about a 95% failure rate. Weight Watchers has a 95% failure rate at the 1-year mark. And last time I looked at the data, it was 95% of those people will be heavier at the 5-year mark. So they're the most famous out there. So what you're saying is, when you do that in this industry, what you're saying is, I figured out something that worked. It's not my problem that you didn't follow it. And technically that is true. But to me, personally, That felt unethical. I'm not trying to say that people who are out there in this industry researching things like ketogenic diets are doing something unethical. I'm just saying that the procedure of how to lose weight is the easy part. You give me a body that I can remove the brain from and put the brain over there in a box for a while, I will give you that body back in bikini body condition every single time. It's simple. But when we put the brain back in, that body's going to get fat because, well, brains are fattening. So,
right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like it's par for the course to try and drop a set of rules on top of unresolved psychological problems that go way back in people's lives. And that being said, I want to throw out a term and I'd like to get your thoughts on it.
Okay.
It's something we talk a lot about. It's a term we talk a lot about. It's a very controversial term, self-esteem. And what comes to mind for you when you hear that?
I think the term itself is good and the intentions were good. A lot of what came out of it, the science didn't really stack up when we measured it. But I think the idea of you liking you, whether or not we call that self-esteem or self-worth, the psychologist David D. Burns, who wrote Feeling Good, he was one of Aaron Beck's graduate students, I think, and Aaron Beck came up with he sort of developed cognitive behavioral therapy. But David Burns said, you will only ever be as happy as your self-worth. And we could swap that out with self-esteem. I've never read a more true statement in all the psychology literature I've ever read. You will only ever be as happy as your self-worth. It's inarguable. When you don't have self-worth, you try to find happiness externally and you will not. There's an entire 2,000-year-old philosophy called Buddhism based on that concept. Like, right. I'm not a Buddhist as far as a religion, but as a philosophy, that was the whole thing the Buddha was doing. When he looked around the world and he saw suffering, he didn't mean poverty and racism and war. He meant people are suffering at the hands of their own brains. And so he went out to try to figure out how to become enlightened. This all comes down to self-worth. If you value you enough, what you are capable of creating with your life is endless. Because think about it. When everything that you do, including your fat loss goals, is self-care, that can't come from an extrinsic motivation. You can't do self-care to impress other people. You do it exclusively because you value you and you are building into a better life for you. You are going out into the world, inputs are coming in, and you are adjusting those inputs to make your life as good as possible. The huge majority of those inputs will be psychological. Very many of them will also be physical. And you are trying to make decisions to reclaim as many of your individual moments as possible. Say, for example, somebody cuts you off in traffic and you have the choice to get upset. Later on, something else little and bad happens. And pretty soon you've got enough of these things that have snowballed that you're laying in bed going, God, I'm glad that day is over. Wait, what? You have a very, very finite amount of days. Your life is going to be a blink in history. And you just got to the end of one of your days and you're glad it's over. And all you had to do was change your thinking. Like, what? No. And when somebody really values themselves and they value being alive, they reclaim their individual moments for the value of the individual moment, not so they can stack them up into something great. Like with nutrition, you sit down and you eat a healthy meal because this meal matters. This is good and healthy. This is a little love note to me. Not so that if I eat 50 of them, I can run over to the scale and see if I'm worth something yet.
Right. Really well said. And the reason why I asked is I think when we're young, we get a pretty destructive sense of what self-esteem is. It's more like others' esteem or pleasing other people, because that's how we're told when we're children that we're good, right?
Yeah.
It's usually about doing what we're supposed to do or making somebody else happy or following rules. And one of the things that we talked a lot about on my show through the years is the work of Nathaniel Brandon, who wrote a book called The Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. He was actually, you mentioned the cognitive behavioral therapist, he was at odds with many of them. And we actually wound up mediating one of these debates on the show a couple of years ago. Mm. But what Brandon was promoting was self-esteem as a series of habits of self-care, of self-love, of self-valuation. He talked about, in the beginning, You have to live consciously. You have to confront what's there, be willing to hug the cactus, so to speak. Yeah. And through that process, you really have to accept yourself. But you don't stop there. A lot of the new agey self-esteem movement of the 1960s was just about hanging it up there and saying, oh, whatever is will be, and I'm fine the way I am. Yeah. So Brandon continued on and said, okay, once you've accepted yourself, you live consciously and you've accepted yourself, take responsibility. And when you understand what your responsibilities are to do better, to feel better, to love yourself or value yourself more, take action, be assertive. That was the fourth pillar. And from there, you can develop a purposeful life of integrity,
I like
pillars
it.
Five and six. So that was a huge boost in my understanding, corrective more, in my understanding of the concept of self-esteem. It helped me. I was first introduced to that maybe in 2013, and I think it was useful in correcting some of my attitudes about fitness and my body and why I do these things. You know, I was a chubby little kid. And that kid got stuck inside me and is still there in parts at 41 years old. Mm-hmm. But I understand that he's there, and I understand why he whispers the things he does. You know, I've been able to mediate that better than I could when I started working out and started trying to be healthy, which was very much vanity driven. But it was also, it's interesting, just a quick tangent here. It was also survival driven. When I was 21 years old, I started working at a boarding school, and this was the beginning of the very beginning of my career in education. And this was a rough place. Took a lot of kids from poor rural areas in the inner city. And it was a violent place. Mm-hmm. And there I was, 21 years old, 5'10", 140 pounds. And these kids were eating not healthy diets plus being on medication. And they had a lot of pounds to throw around. And I would wind up, it would almost be like we had to do physical interventions and break up fights. And I wound up walking away from this particular school because a lot of these things really came to bother me. But at 140 pounds, trying to intervene in those situations, you're just basically at a rodeo. Hmm. And it was a supervisor said to me, you should start hitting the gym. And I, for some vanity reasons, had also tried to turn things around, put on a lot of weight in college from drinking too much and, you know, eating bagels and ice cream, whatever. You know, I mean, those were the easy to get things in the dining hall at college. So I'd shuffle in there in slippers and eat those things, and I didn't care. So around 21 years old, I really started to turn this around, but I really didn't develop a healthy attitude, I think, about my body or about my relationship with food. And I still think I have a ways to go in both cases, but that wasn't happening until my 30s. And it certainly wasn't happening until I started to focus more on the psychology of this whole pursuit.
Yeah. And that's the part where I like cognitive behavioral therapy, in that people need to be able to question their cognitive distortions. There is no statement that I've ever heard out of a psychologist's mouth that I hate more. And you, surprisingly, you hear it out of a lot of them, then your emotions are all valid. They're your emotions. They can't be wrong. There's nothing that I disagree with less. Like there are only two different things that create emotions, and that's thoughts and hormones. So when you say that all emotions are valid, what you're saying is, I am an insecure woman. I don't like my body. I just got done beating myself up for what I looked like in the mirror. Now I walk into a room full of people. These people all turn their heads and look at me, and I've never met any of them before. I could, with the data that I have right now, jump to the conclusion that they are all picturing me naked because they think I'm so gorgeous. But instead, I know that I don't like me. So me being ugly must be a fact. So now I'm going to be the judgmental jerk, and I'm going to say, and if I said it out loud, they'd all be mad at me. I'm going to say, these people are all being judgmental jerks, for lack of the better word there. They are looking at me and deciding that I am less than them because of the shape of my body. Now I feel bad. I'm having negative emotions. I want to leave. I have anxiety, frustration, maybe even anger, and I want to run out of here. And I made it all up. Oh, but all of my emotions are valid, right? No, you just built all of this standing there. And if you don't have the ability to question what's going on with you cognitively and go, wait a minute, why am I allowing this in my head right now? My thoughts are choices. I get to choose. I mean, they don't feel like it because you practice them so much that they become your knee-jerk reaction. But I could change my thoughts. And, you know, there's countless examples of how that can be done just in meditation alone. But I'm choosing to have this thought. I'm choosing to stand here and think that these people are all judging me. Therefore, there must be some positive outcome, right? I'm saying to myself, if I stand here and feel terrible while these people judge me, then something great's going to happen. That's going to make me more likely to go for my walk later, right? Or I'll be even more likely to eat a better dinner. No, you're more likely to be hopeless and say it's all not worth it and nothing was going to work anyway and just go ahead and dive to the bottom of a tub of ice cream.
Right. Yeah.
So if you can't change those thoughts and go, there's no facts here. Nothing happened. Nobody said anything to me. Nobody came up to me. And do I do that? If the tables were turned and I watch somebody walk in and I glance up and I see somebody else, do I immediately look at the shape of their body and go, oh, she's not in shape. I don't want to be her friend. I don't want to go into a business relationship with her. I hope she doesn't come talk to me. No, you don't do that. So who would be? Only jerks. Anybody that would be, you shouldn't care about anyway, but you still would never even know. You still would never even know if that's how they thought. And yet you're choosing to stay in that spot. That creates hopelessness. Do that multiple times a day. And those things end with things like binge eating.
Sure. Yeah. The consequences of those beliefs, right? I mean, that's cognitive behavioral therapy. Is there are these activating events. They could be internal or external. Part of CBT is recognizing, like you said, that you have beliefs that are dysfunctional. It might be okay that you have them, right? And you shouldn't beat yourself up for having dysfunctional beliefs, but understand that they're dysfunctional and that they have negative consequences. And then the follow-up in CBT is a process of self-mediation where you dispute them on the spot.
Get to work.
Right.
Start doing the work.
And then you can get effective new beliefs, effective new emotional consequences, effective new actions out of that. I see CBT kind of as like in real time psychological, it's like psychological maintenance. I don't think it is a contained psychological solution. I think it's very useful on the spot to go through certain CBT exercises, but it's, I would say, and what we've promoted on this show is that it should be coupled with things like, you know, understanding the traumas or the parts of yourself that come from much earlier in life, which is almost a whole separate process. But of course, CBT is very, very useful in the moment in self-mediation, self-intervention, almost a lot of the time, depending on what it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Another example, your hands reaching out for that cupcake. The intervention would be, why do I want that? Why do I want that cupcake? Well, I had a bad day. My boss is a jerk. Oh yeah, cupcakes always make bosses not be jerks.
Right.
Your stressor is not related to your stress. Your stress and your stressor are two different things. And you can't medicate a stress and make a stressor change. But chances are you're just going, well, that cupcake looks like it would taste good. Okay, so on the one side we have, why do I want the cupcake? Well, it would taste very good. Yum is my whole reason, my entire reason. Okay, so why would I not want to eat the cupcake? And most people will make the mistake there of starting to say, well, cupcakes are bad for me, or I shouldn't have it because it doesn't align with my diet. That's the wrong tact. You build a pros list for the cupcake and a pros list for your goals. So why do the rest of the day do I tell myself that I want to stay on track? Well, I want to look, feel, and perform good. I want to have a better relationship with me. I want to treat myself like I would treat a good friend and just simply follow through on the things I say I'm going to do. And I want to, you know, have better hair and skin and digestion and hormones and sex drive and energy levels and mood. I want to set a good example for the people who look up to me, like my kids. I want to be better in all of my relationships. You pick any one of those things and they're better than yum. Any one of those things. That's the cognitive intervention right there. But that's not what people will typically do because it's not what they're taught to do. They're taught to follow the rules. What are the rules? Don't eat cupcakes. Okay, so I'm going to spend the rest of my life being somebody who really loves cupcakes, who will just white knuckle her way through every time I see a cupcake.
No,
you won't. You will have a bad day. You will get frustrated. You will be really hungry and find yourself in the face of a cupcake. You will, those things will happen to you because you've done nothing to change your relationship with cupcakes. Your thoughts on cupcakes are the exact same thing. So my job is not to get you to quit eating cupcakes. That's not my job. You'll do that all by yourself. My job is to teach you how to change your relationship with cupcakes by changing your thoughts. When I teach you how to think differently on the fly, being mindful in the moment, you will turn into somebody that goes, yeah, that's a desk. That's a chair. There's some grass. That's a cupcake. There's a cloud. Wait, go back to the cupcake thing. What was that? I don't know what that is. Oh, it's this tasty confection thing that people make. Well, don't you want it? No, I don't want it. It's just a cupcake. There it is.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I also wonder, too, if most people, once they accumulate some success with adopting a new way of eating. I mean, this is what happened to me. I don't know how common it is. It's like a lot of those things, they don't really seem like food or options anymore. You know, like mm-hmm. I used to leave the gym when I was 25 years old. And man, you know, I was ripped. I was in great shape. I was so strong. I would go to the convenience store. I would order a 12-inch sub and I would get Ben and Jerry's ice cream and I'd go home and eat it. And I would do that 4 days a week. And then suddenly, I guess I wasn't 25 anymore and that didn't work. But man, I remember when that worked. And man, I remember how delicious Ben and Jerry's ice cream was. I can't even remember the last time at this point that I felt a craving for it. And that used to be the go-to thing, right? When there was a bad day, when there was a sad moment, Ben and Jerry's was like the ultimate comfort food. And after I really think it's changed just in the last couple of years for me. But those kinds of things that I used to walk by and stand there and have some kind of negotiation with myself about why I can have this, they don't happen anymore.
Right. You don't, I mean, you and I don't walk down the street and see somebody smoking a cigarette and go, oh my God, I'm just going to white knuckle it until they go by so I don't have to run over there and ask them for a cigarette. And yet cigarettes are highly addictive, and very many people right at this moment are either dying from smoking them or are really struggling trying to quit. Mm. But we think differently about those things. We don't have a relationship with them. Some of that is physical, but a huge part of it is psychological. I don't care if you get past the cravings for cupcakes by not eating any sweets for 2 weeks. 6 months from now, if you are still somebody who thinks of cupcakes as an inherent good in the universe, then you will always be able to hit yourself with that, your inner voice saying, it's been long enough, right? You've gone long enough. Well, you could have one now. Or look at how good you've been on your diet. You could have one, because they're still a good. They're still positive. You haven't changed any of that. And I'm not saying vilify them. I'm saying you need to change the way you think by deliberately changing your thoughts on the fly, like we talked about a moment ago. Yeah. When we were talking about what's the value of this cupcake. And then practicing that, because this is a skill, not a destination. So you get on the bike and you ride it, and then you fall off and you get right back on and you ride it again. And 10 years from now, you're amazing on a bike. And that's what we're all doing when we're actually winning, when it comes to changing how we interact with the health inputs in our lives. But to think that I'm going to do that because the rules say don't eat cupcakes, that's asinine. You won't. I guarantee you won't. It's not my job to tell you to quit eating cupcakes. It's my job to teach you how to think differently about cupcakes. And that takes a while, but it's worth it.
Awesome. So look, I'll be honest. We already got a lot more out of this show, a lot of things that I didn't expect we'd get out of this conversation. And that's great, but we still have a ways to go. And I envisioned it as being more of a kind of diet and fitness nerd show, right?
Now, let's do it. Let's do that now.
That's all great stuff. And that really, again, like I said, it aligns with a lot of the ways we've treated these subjects before. It's been a while, so it's great to hear you say so many of these things. But as I look to, you know, consciously evaluate what I'm doing, which I kind of do that area by area of life. And I've spent a lot of time in the last couple months doing it with my business, and then with the weather getting nice and, trying some new things at the gym or looking for some new things to do in the kitchen, I shifted to health and fitness. And that's what has me thinking about Alt Shift, which is very much just like an automatic part of my life. Like, it gets talked about a lot because people say, how come on this day you do this? And how come on that day you do that? And how does that work? And so there is like an explanation when I encounter new people. But we talked about the research behind the diet. You said a lot of your work led you to really looking at it from an evolutionary biology approach. But I also wanted to talk about the guidelines and the foundation. So like how you actually came up with this specific protocol and what the protocol is.
You know, at the time I owned a public gym. You know, paleo wasn't doing it for too many of the people I was working with, especially women. Men always have an easier time with weight loss. And again, that goes back to the fact that almost all men are already intrinsically motivated. They just don't have enough motivation, usually. If they can just do virtually any protocol that'll produce health, they usually get pretty dramatic results because, well, testosterone, muscle mass, all those amazing things that make wives get mad at husbands when they start dieting
together. Sure, right.
But there were some things that I had been saying, like, you know, just throwing out there as like parts of seminars and things like that, that started to hit me that what we were doing wasn't really jiving with some of this logic. One of them was, if you are a hunter-gatherer and you're in your tribe and somebody brings down a hippo, you don't think to yourself, okay, we got the hippo, so what's the vegetable and wine pairing with hippo?
Right, right.
You know, you just eat the hippo until the hippo's gone or too rotten to eat because it's going to go bad. And those tubers in the ground over there and that fruit on the tree, likely going to stay there for another couple of days. So mixing these things together, especially starches and fat, as I started to think about this more, started to seem to me like things that were just not the logical way that this probably would have went down as we lived, you know, 20,000 years ago. So it wasn't just the food list that was good enough. We had to think about how people would have taken in these foods. And most of the people that were doing paleo were doing it from this low carb perspective. And now keto is really popular, but we've done this before. It was called Atkins.
Right. Yeah.
And it took people to usually to some decent results and then a plateau and then very often some real weirdness. Like you talked about your friend who hit a plateau, but some people, especially a lot of the women, will end up, those sleep disruptions and energy kind of tanks and some stuff that just tends to point towards, hey, hormones aren't quite where they should be.
Oh, sure. And when I've talked about keto or just low carb, I mean, that's where we started, right? Like, I mean, when I was into fitness in my 20s, it was like, you know, reading Muscle and Fitness magazine, fast carbs, slow carbs, eat 200 grams of protein a day. When I found low carb diets, I was like, sweet, that eliminates so many variables and concerns and questions. Don't eat carbs. Yeah. So I embraced it for simplicity and I promoted it on the show, like, or certainly talked about it positively for years. And people would write me letters like, hey, my eyes are bulging out of my head. And I'd be like, okay, well then it might not be for you. And that's what I realized when I started to have friends who would get blood work done and meet with nutritionists. Like, yes, this is not for everybody. And it is certainly depriving yourselves of carbs. The ketogenic diet is a stressor on your body. And if you've already got a few of those stressors stacked up, it might not be the healthiest thing for certain people to implement.
Certainly. And we were then vilifying a whole macronutrient. And especially like starch. I mean, we have amylase right in our saliva. That's the enzyme that we use to break down starch. From the very first bite of food, we start breaking down starch. And we're going to say that this just isn't a good idea for human beings. It just didn't make sense to me. And so, things like white rice, which is technically still a grain, but almost entirely starch. And then potatoes and sweet potatoes and yams and taro root and all this other stuff that can be much higher in starch, but very much resembles the way we would have gotten starch as hunter-gatherers. That stuff just started to seep back in to my thinking from that low-carb paleo world, but in a fashion that said, what happens when we eat this stuff separately from the fat?
Right.
And so I knew, you know, cyclical ketogenic diets had been around for a long time, very long time. That a lot of people have tried to reinvent the wheel and claim that they came up with this. You've got the people that do the cheat meal or the cheat day.
Have you heard of carb night?
Yeah, that's where I was going. I just wasn't going to say it.
No one gave us guidelines. I've tried it with a bunch of low carb friends back in 2013. I made two trays of nachos and then ate a pint of Ben and Jerry's. And the next day I felt like I needed one of those chairs that goes up the stairs on a rail to get around. Like I felt like I had seriously done damage to my body just from that first in a long time carb binge. And I said, there's no way this is healthy. There's no way this is okay.
Yeah. And all of those were basically based on the fact that carbs are terrible, but you got to be able to cheat sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's not the direction my thinking was going in. I wasn't trying to say carbs are terrible. I was trying to say, I think they're very valuable, but I don't think that we necessarily ate them the way that we're eating them now. And so I started experimenting with how often we could put them in as a valuable part of the diet in a healthy way, not a, all the results happen when you're low carb. When you add the carbs in, you're just taking a cheat day, or you're taking a break from that for a while. And it's going to be good to help you stay on track. That wasn't my thinking at all. I was trying to figure out how to create great high starch and high carb days. And the outcome of that was Alt Shift. And the protocol in a nutshell alternates between two shifts, 5-shift and 3-shift. And it is, the benefit is that it cycles starch, it cycles fat, and it cycles calories while separating starch and fat. So all four of those things happen, and all four of them are just as valuable as all the others.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I have to beat into the low carb paleo people when they come in. They think that they'll get it in their head that 3-shift is a place for deviations. It's a place to go, well, if I'm going to eat that cupcake, I'm going to do it on 3-shift because 3-shift is where the break is anyway. And then, no, that's not what's happening. 3-shift is extremely important to your results. And so 5-shift and 3-shift do all of this alternating to get the carbs separated from the starch, the cycling of the fats, the cycling of the carbs, and the cycling of the calories. And we can do pretty much all of that without counting anything.
So the guidelines that I follow for doing this on the 5-shift, carbs are under 30 grams. That's really the only macro number that I'm paying attention to. And just eating, you're trying to eat meat at every meal. Obviously, there's plenty of fibrous vegetables you can eat. So avoiding any kind of starch. There are a few days where I'll throw like just a little handful of blueberries in full fat yogurt, but those 5 days work pretty well. The only guideline that I am at this point following, this is why I'm here to tell on myself, to correct this, to do better at this, or to optimize this, I should say, is under 40 grams of fat on the 3-shift days, the starch up, the carb up days. So
I don't count any of that, to tell you the truth.
Oh, really? Well, no. I mean, you can kind of, that's the thing, is that after you do it for a month or two, you know what you can eat, and you're not measuring or counting, especially if you've done low carb for a while, or you've experimented with keto or paleo, you know what to eat to stay in that range. And I think a lot of people in my audience have experience with that.
I don't even think it takes experience. The way I teach it in my coaching programs now is, here's the food list.
Yeah.
Here's the 3-shift foods. Here's the 5-shift foods. If you count anything, you're doing it wrong, because what you're setting up is a relationship with food that is based on math. And that's a really crappy way to have a relationship with food. So I tell people that counting anything is a late game play. You won't do that until we've done everything else right. So first off, the food is, you only put foods in the right shifts. Then you need to be walking your 10,000 steps a day. You need to be getting your 8 hours of sleep a night during human hours, you know, prioritizing sleep. You're not on your phone in your bed, things like that. You need to be meditating every day, and we'll teach you how to do that. Those are your base camp tasks. When you've got all of those things dialed in, most people will have phenomenal results, and a lot of people won't have to go beyond that. But from there, and I mean, one place I do recommend that everybody goes is very shortly after you're even just getting close on your base camp tasks, you need to throw in resistance training, because that's, well, it's just mandatory. You will not create a body in peak health without resistance training, and there's absolutely no denying that in the science. We're not doing any cardio, by all means. All of that stops, and we do eventually add in sprinting in most cases. So there is some of the huffing and puffing, but it's not it's only in the short term, for it's very intense, something your body can understand, much like getting away from a tiger or catching prey, mm-hmm. not running for a half hour wondering why this three-legged tiger can't catch me. And then, you know, there are other things. Intermittent fasting works really well as a late game play. Then, you know, once a lot of those things are in place, then I'll have people, if they still aren't getting the results that they want, some of those people will need to look at their fat, carbs, and their calorie splits between the shifts. But again, that's usually not in any time in less than 6 months.
Right. So the 3-shift foods, when we talk about calorie variation, when you go into the 3-shifts, your calories are going to naturally fall because you're not getting as much fat, which has more calories per gram. So you will see a reduction in, I mean, I never, ever, would ever count calories. But I know just from my knowledge of food happening in the back, maybe there's a little math happening subconsciously in the back of my head, which is why I threw out the 30 grams and 40 grams numbers. But,
and they're important. Yeah. Those numbers are in the book. They're important to know downstream. But yeah, I mean, if you eat steak and broccoli and then tomorrow you eat chicken and rice, you're going to have a hard time getting the chicken and rice calories to meet the steak and broccoli calories if that was a big, fat, fatty steak.
You're going to have a terrible time. Your jaw is going to hurt by the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So just a note on ketosis. If there is anyone who's unfamiliar with this, ketosis is just a state where your body burns fat instead of sugar for energy. So this was actually something that was a question for me when I started doing this. Obviously, when you go from this ketogenic state, which you can get into on the 5-day shift, where carbs are restricted and fat is way up, you're not staying in it when you go over to the 3-day shift, but that's the idea. How do you, since everybody's different, how much attention should you pay or research should an individual do into making sure when they shift back to 5, they have that kind of metabolic flexibility to switch back over to burning ketones?
I don't think that the huge majority, in my experience, even all the people that I measured, the vast majority of people will not be able to get into ketosis in 5 days. And it typically means that they, in order to do it, they're going to have to likely be training hard enough to eat up muscle glycogen because they've thoroughly replenished it during 3 shifts.
Right, right.
So their glycogen, muscle and liver glycogen, has to be completely burned up. Their metabolic flexibility would have to be amazing so that the day they start 5 shift, they shift over and immediately start eating all that stuff up and burn up all of that that glycogen. And then throughout that time, they're going to have to not replenish any of it. They might be able to get into ketosis on day 5, but I don't think that's an essential factor. I mean, it was never my intent to get people into ketosis. There's no magic that happens in ketosis. It's just an indicator that you are out of glycogen, that you're running on ketones at the cell. And that in the short term, things like intermittent fasting work because you don't, you know, you just have like an 8-hour eating window. And eventually you get to a point where unless you go put a lot of strain on your body starts to turn to your stored body fat for energy. Right. You don't need to be in ketosis for that.
Okay.
What you need is good metabolic flexibility. And metabolic flexibility is defined as your ability to shift back and forth from glucose to fatty acids at the cell. So at the mitochondria, when we're feeding different substrates into the cell to get, you know, ATP energy, you remember the Krebs cycle from biology class where we all went cross-eyed as our teacher tried to teach us that.
Of course, we all remember. No one would have forgotten. Right.
Right. Exactly. So the good metabolic flexibility says, the glucose is gone. Cool. Let's switch over and burn some fat. And you know, that could be fat that we ate or fat that we've got stored, but we easily switch over to that. It doesn't suck. You don't get that low carb flu. When people first start alt shift or keto or whatever, when you take carbs away, even just for the 5 days in 5 shift, you end up at that place where you're not thinking real clearly. You're a little lightheaded. You're starting to read the same paragraph a couple of times because you can't process what you're doing. That's called low carb flu. There's oftentimes tons of cravings that come with it. All of it can be fairly miserable. And that's because for a short period of time there, you're dealing with a body that has adapted to burning carbohydrates to the degree that it thinks that carbohydrates are food. That's the whole list. What is food? Carbohydrates. So when you take them away, your body goes, where's the food? Give us food. And that's called a craving. And you have to stick it out long enough to go, we have plenty of food. The pantry is full. Right. It's completely full. And what's in there is food, body. And you're going to pay attention to that from now on. You're not going to demand carbohydrates at every single meal. Unfortunately, most people will get to that and then they'll have a little bit of carbohydrates and they pretty much start the process over.
Right.
So it's tough in the beginning. You got to go hard. It's like pedaling your bike up a hill. My friend Mark Rogers says that if you stop pedaling while you're still on the hill, you're going to roll backwards. But if you pedal long enough to get to the top, then you'll coast. No big deal.
Right. So I think one of the biggest benefits of what you've been talking about for me personally was a reduction in anxiety. Like I also, from the time I was like a teenager, struggled with physical symptoms of anxiety. And I could not make this connection when I started doing this maybe in like 2010. But my bouts of like not anxiety attacks, things that last like 5 minutes, but like sustained anxious feelings. My cravings for alcohol between like 2010 and 2013, before I like realized this, went through the roof, and I couldn't understand why, but I felt much more stressed, and I didn't realize that I was, this was a very important stressor, this glycogen depletion that I was not prepared to deal with. So that being said, I want to talk about some of the benefits. And then, you know, we've been talking for a little bit over an hour. I've learned that you're a very patient and understanding man. Before we started recording, though, I was like, geez, I better save all the things that will make him angry about what I'm doing until the very end. So we still have to get to that, too. And I know you'll be understanding about them, too, because this stuff happens.
But perfect.
Obviously, number one benefit for me of doing this has been sustainability. I've never stuck with any way of eating for, you know, 14 months in a row. Low carb, keto, paleo, there was always some kind of compromise, some kind of emergency. I would say that at 41 years old, I'm leaner and stronger than maybe I've ever been in my life. Certainly. I mean, maybe like I was competitive with myself now when I was like 25. And this was until recently. I actually, when it comes to strength, I had a back injury. I popped an SI joint, which also messes with your sciatic nerve. So it takes out like a lot of the heavier moves that I get a lot of pleasure out of doing, like squats and deadlifts. So can't do those things. But it's interesting that the Alt Shift Lift book actually helped with that too, because there's ways that you can still get great workouts without moving as much weight, like cluster sets, which I had never heard of before. And maybe it's because like a lot of people are afraid to talk about them because they're so insane. But anytime that I need like a change of pace, I throw one of those in there. A cluster set is when you stick with the same weight for 10 reps, and then you take 5 to 10 second breaks between each set, and you descend, like after you do this 10 times. And at the end with that same weight, maybe you can do one or two reps. And for certain body parts, it is just absolutely amazing. So instead of, you know, three sets of heavy squats, I with an injury that I did get cleared to do some physical activity with, maybe I'll just jump on a leg extension machine and do a cluster set. And I don't feel like my quads know the difference. So that's another benefit, less anxiety. I mentioned better cardiovascular health, deep, consistent sleep, something that I've almost never had in my life, getting more than 6 hours, like, you know, averaging, I think, according to my Fitbit data, like 7.5 to 8 most nights. Energy levels are great, less illness. I feel like my immune system is much stronger. I definitely have seen improvements in metabolic flexibility. When I started doing this, the three shifts, the carb, even though I was getting more carbs, and you think, oh, you know, remember carbo night before baseball or football or hockey, whatever, where you just eat pasta? I was really struggling because I wasn't eating bread and pasta on those three shifts. My calories were falling really low, and I was feeling it at the gym. But as time went on, I started to just, it didn't matter what shift I was on, the workout started to feel the same. And that was an indication that I was being more fuel efficient, so to speak. And here's the other thing, is that back to what the first thing I said in the show today, when I looked at the book, this is fun. It's like, it's exciting to go back to, I do the bulletproof coffee on the low carb days. And that's like one of my favorite ways to start a morning. But if you can have it every morning, that's not special. But if you take 3 days off from having it, when it's time to have it again, that's really great. And so is egg. So is bacon. Mm-hmm. The switching back and forth, really something that I think has helped make it sustainable, because it always feels like there's something to look forward to. Now, I said the word fun, but I'm starting to worry that I'm having too much fun. and here's the problem. Okay. So I read the book in 2017, and now, and maybe this has been evident in this conversation, I retain only essences of it. I have the food list. I actually just went to your website and bought the whole Alt Shift kit, which is like the Body Beliefs book.
Jumpstart.
Alt Shift Jumpstart, because I had lost my PDFs of the other stuff. So I had only retained the essences of the Alt Shift diet book, and I think I had done so selectively, right? So it's an important theme of this show that we're recording right now, and in this larger project, this larger collection of shows that is School Sucks, to take a conscious approach to things with, you know, self-acceptance as a foundation, but also focused on improvement. So here we are. My cheats, and I distinguish cheats from well-deserved indulgences that happen once in a while. Maybe there's been three times where I was on a cruise like last October. I had a piece of cake. Couldn't even eat the whole thing. Was just like, that tastes good, and moved on and stayed on the diet on a cruise, which is easy to do when everything's a buffet. But,
yeah,
you know, it reminds me of something that I've seen you write and heard you say, that modern hyper-palatable food, the kind of food that most of us probably grew up on, basically broke our taste buds. You say taste buds evolved to signal what food is good for us to eat, right?
Yeah, it always meant health in nature.
Right.
If something was hyper palatable, it was hyper nutritious.
So now it means something else. And
totally.
I have a bit of a sweet tooth. I have actually found myself looking forward to these three shift days where I've started to incorporate things. Now, I haven't seen physical consequences of doing this. But if I continue to not see physical consequences of doing this, there's going to be a voice in my head that says, it's okay to keep doing that, Brett. But I know it kind of, I know it isn't, right? So eating granola cereal, that would be an example. If I can stay inside whatever the macro requirements are, things otherwise go off the rails. I ate gummy bears recently, you know? Ooh. Now, I heard you. These aren't things that I want to do. But even on the other days, I find things that, like, I don't know if they're okay or not, because even though a majority of my diet is whole foods, I find myself finding more and more treats. I don't know how you feel about, like, stevia or xylitol.
I can answer all of this at the same time.
So you don't need the list. You don't. Okay.
Well, what I mean by that is the artificial sweeteners for me fall into the exact same category as the gummy bears and the granola and all that. And it's because what you're talking about now is dieting. Mm. And you're saying, to what degree do these things fit into the rules? My only concern is behavior. So for example, when I try to get somebody to beat a sweet tooth, my advice is always that you quit eating all sweet things, even fruit for a while. And people go, fruit, but fruit's good for me. Okay, yeah, fine. You're right. Fruit is good for you. It should absolutely be part of your diet. But you're looking at this wrong. When you're saying I have a sweet tooth, what you mean is I eat too much sugar. And that's not the problem. The problem is that you value sweet flavors too highly. And that's a behavior issue now. We could set the rule, don't eat sugar, and you could just start throwing stevia in all your coffee. And, you know, we could set the rule that you don't eat bread. So you go out and you find a way to make paleo bread. You know, all of these things keep you in a place where, with the sugar thing, you're worshiping at the feet of the sugar gods, and you're not willing to change that. So you do whatever you can to stay a person who loves sweet flavors without breaking the rules.
Right.
And thereby, you are always hanging your toes over the edge of that cliff. For example, you're that person who makes paleo bread at home all the time. You sit down in a restaurant and that waiter drops that bread on your table. You're not going to say, oh, there's bread. I don't really care about bread anymore. You're definitely going to say, well, this is kind of a special occasion. We never really see these people. I haven't had real bread in a really long time. I could have this bread, right? Because your behavior still says bread is glorious, not I don't need bread anymore.
What if,
because
I don't want to put up too much resistance here, because that's probably also a sign of a problem. But if I'm the kind of guy who would say, great, I have stevia, there's my coffee, in it goes. But if I was in another situation where it was time for coffee and someone said, we only have sugar, I would say, I'll have it black, right? Like, putting sugar in something.
Wait, how do you figure? You ate those gummy bears for no other reason than they were sweet.
That's, you know, you're right. But, like, I feel like there's more of a habit with the coffee thing where, like, if somebody gave me sugar, maybe something about the actual physical act of spooning sugar into my food.
Well, let's use a different example and say that you drink Diet Coke all the time.
It's happened.
That's a situation where people are drinking something solely for the fact that it's sweet. If you crawl out of a desert and you haven't had a drink in 2 days, you are not going to ask for a Diet Coke.
Right.
You're going to ask for water. So you might be kind of thirsty when you want this Diet Coke, but you're not really jonesing for liquid, or you'd be going for water.
Right.
So why you're drinking this is solely for flavor. It's a liquid. It isn't even food. We don't eat ice cream when we're hungry either, typically. But I mean, when you're drinking a sweetened beverage, it's because yum. And thereby you are saying yum has a lot of value. What is it? What is that value? Tell me what that value is. It is supposed to be, I tasted something fantastic, and the system, the couple million year old system, actually, when we're talking about taste buds, it'd be a lot longer than that. But the system says, I taste something sweet, and my taste buds, which I evolved to find nutrition in nature, acknowledge that it tastes good and say, that is good for you. And then dopamine comes along, and dopamine is your wanting hormone. It's not a liking hormone. It makes you repeat things. It says, that was really good for you. Find as much of it as you can right now, and then remember how and where you got it. And when you encounter this again, do it again. Because we've now added something to the list that is very good for you. And the more dopamine, the more coveted this will be, and the harder you will work to get it again. But when you're drinking Diet Coke, the whole system's broken. Your taste buds go, oh my God, that was amazing. That's so good for you. Do it again, often. Mm. But what? Why? Why would you do this again often? Especially when there are so many things out there that are similar enough and are far more. I think Diet Coke is horrible for you. But even when we just say stevia all by itself in a laboratory, cell to cell, doesn't seem to be a lot of damage. There's some people that have even argued for some very moderate and sort of tenuous, in my opinion, health benefits. But nonetheless, the behavior is broken. It says sweet is important when it does not mean nutrition. Sweet does not indicate do this again because it's good for you. It just means yum. I bit into this or I tasted it and I hear a choir of angels. And that by itself is valuable without the nutrition that it should indicate. And now you're in trouble. Now you're somebody who likes sweet only for sweet. And that's not what your taste buds were evolved for.
No, I totally agree with what you're saying, but I'm trying to be a good advocate here for maybe the thousands of people who are listening to this and saying, but what are you saying? That food isn't supposed to be pleasurable?
No, it's absolutely supposed to be pleasurable. Okay. It's just supposed to mean that it's good for you.
All right.
Think about it. Hunter-gatherers ate food and loved it. They gathered around at night around it. That's when they told their stories and enjoyed each other. We gathered over food. It was almost a spiritual thing. You spent all day doing the job that everybody did, which was to go get food. And you got together and you ate that food. And it was wonderful. And it tasted amazing. And there were certain things that were prized better than others that you went and worked even harder to get when you could get them. Or certain seasons when you could get certain things that were amazing. That is all fantastic. But in every case, the flavor indicated the nutrition of the thing you were eating. Mm. What we have now is a situation where people have taken flavor from something else, like pulling sugar out of sugar cane or beets or whatever, and adding it to something solely to make this thing taste better. So the gauge goes up, but what's in the tank doesn't go up. You've just been told this is really, really good for you, but it's not. So when you're staring down the barrel of a cheesecake, every cell in your body is saying, that's the right answer. You should eat that as much as you can. It has to be really, really good for you. And all the systems in place are designed to make it that way, all the way to the dopamine. Everything that you feel about it, even the psychology behind it, is telling you it has to be the right answer. But the environment has been broken, and now there's such a thing as junk food.
Yes.
So now if you listen to your ancient survival drives without using the only part of your body that tells you not to eat it, which is your tiny little prefrontal cortex in the front of your brain, if you listen to the rest of your body and do exactly what it tells you, you get to 55, 60 years old and get your foot cut off before you die from type 2 diabetes. So your survival drives, literally the things that are the reason why you and I can have this conversation, the reason why there's such a thing as human beings, have now been destroyed by, well, you know, what is basically industry.
Right.
This didn't become a real problem, a huge problem, until, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago when the food industry started battling amongst themselves to make things that were, if my product is more palatable than yours, people will buy mine. So nutrition didn't matter. It was a palatability race.
Right.
And
right.
When you drive up palatability without driving up nutrition, you have people eating, which is what is essentially crap, just in order to hear that choir of angels when they bite into it. So the intervention isn't stop eating those things. They're bad for you. Find other versions of them that are exactly the same, but not bad for you. That doesn't address behavior at all. you're now the same person that you've always been. You're precariously waiting to eat the next gummy bear.
That's
and
it.
Try to justify.
Right. And I knew that and I felt that. And believe me, I don't want to be a pawn of the food industry. So I felt like I said, this feels, this on paper, if I wrote down all the, and I would never do this, but if I wrote down all the macronutrients and all the calories, would I be in the basic essence of criteria of alt shift? Sure. But if it was descriptions of some of the things that I found myself eating, especially on the three shift, it is way out of the criteria of what you recommend right. in that book, because I just reread it. And I'm very glad that I spent this time talking to you about it, because I think this is something that I want to – this is obviously something I want to pay more attention to and clean up for myself, but also understand the attitudes and the behaviors that are still attached to this, because I started to feel like, oh, I'm telling myself a story about how I'm doing all the right things – but I'm still finding these little holes where I can slip in what I'm pretty sure, especially after I do them, feel like unhelpful habits, unhelpful choices.
Yeah, that's always the behavior versus rules argument.
Right.
Always for me. And that was one of my big frustrations with when we released Alt Shift and I didn't have a lot of these other pieces in place so people could come in and just do the Alt Shift diet. And I mean, you don't have to look any farther than paleo to see examples of this. Paleo was just destroyed by this. These concepts of rules rather than behavior. Paleo was this beautiful question. It said, what created health in humans in nature? And that could be extrapolated out to movement and all kinds of things. But when we just looked at diet, it was generally what did humans eat that created health? And if we have something now that isn't on that list, it's suspect. We need to look close at it. It doesn't necessarily, like I said earlier, it's not, you know, dogma.
Right.
But it was the scientific question. Then it became a diet. And once it became a diet, it was, don't eat, you know, grains, legumes, dairy. And it was this list of foods to not eat and a list of foods to eat. And the very next day, we can start writing cookbooks. So now you've got the, you know, whole cookbooks on nothing but paleo desserts. Whole cookbooks on nothing but things like, you know, the versions of baked goods that your grandma used to make.
Oh, absolutely.
They're all paleo.
Go into the finger quotes health section of any, Walmart, any drugstore. Look at the Atkins snacks that they have there. It's amazing that diet didn't kill everybody that went on it. You know, I mean, the ingredients list, the kids' cereals in the supermarket have less illegible ingredients than Atkins finger quotes health food does.
Right. Yeah. And this is that behavior versus rules thing. People aren't trying to change their behavior. They're trying to go, okay, what can I fit into the rules of this diet?
Yeah.
And when they don't change their behavior, they don't change their thoughts. They don't change how they interact with these things. Again, you do not become somebody who looks at bread and goes, I don't need that. I don't really care about that. If you've been constantly at home eating bread that is, you know, quote unquote acceptable on your diet. And I had to get out of that whole paleo arena because it just got broken. It was just, nobody can come in and break alt shifts because I own it. But people have certainly had these conversations with me where they've wanted to try to figure out how to make these recipes that would still fit the rules. And you're doing it wrong. You're doing it wrong if you're trying to figure out, you know, how many strawberries can you have on five shift and still come in under the 30 grams of carbs. But strawberries are healthy. I'm just trying to follow the rules. Okay, but that's not what we're doing.
Right.
We're putting the right foods in the right shifts, and you're doing a diet. I'm just telling you when to eat things.
Right. Yep.
So as soon as it becomes all about the rules, people will always revert back to what they know about dieting. What is a diet? It's a set of rules on how to eat. And you usually expect to be able to say it in one sentence, you know, or one breath. What was Atkins? Well, it was under 20 grams of carbs for the induction phase. And then you go up to 30 grams and maybe you might even be able to creep it up a little higher than that down the road. But that was the gist of the diet. Weight Watchers. Well, you count points and you keep it under a certain amount of points and you get the target points for your own body. And that's how you lose weight. I mean, we just expect to be able to explain these things like they sum up how human beings survived on this planet for all these years.
Absolutely. Well,
they don't.
Yeah. You know, this is one of the things that we've always promoted on this show, self-management and self-leadership versus, you know, following somebody else's script which is basically what so much of this diet advice and these plans and these programs are all about, just following some other script, adhering to rules, instead of consciously working to change one's beliefs and behaviors. So
yes,
thank you so much for an awesome conversation / granola cereal intervention and gummy bear intervention.
no problem. It's what I do.
You know, but I did want to say you opened a door for sushi to come back through in my life. And that was a major quality of life enhancement for me.
It's a miracle.
Yes. So
sushi's a miracle.
Thank you so much for doing that. One of many quality of life enhancements from doing this. So I'm going to hold myself accountable to be more conscious of this, to make some changes. You and I already talked before we started that we'll connect again in the near future. And I'd love to update you on that.
Yeah, I would. That'd be great. And I'd love to come back here if it's ever appropriate.
Yeah, I would love to have you back, Jason. Can you tell my listeners where they could find more of you if they're interested in getting these books that we talked about or learning about other services that you provide?
Yeah, you can just go to jasonseib.com. My last name is spelled S-E-I-B, as in Bravo, jasonseib.com, and everything is there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I look forward to talking again in the future.
I look forward to it, too. Thanks for having me.
Stop and go a long way.